Hello and welcome into Emergency F, news and information on topics that shape the Community Foundation world. I'm your host, Eric Ozempa. All right, today we have a special guest all the way from Nebraska. Alec Gorinsky is the president and CEO of the Lincoln Community Foundation. Welcome in, Alex.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for being here. And let's see, a little bit about Alec. He joined the Lincoln Community Foundation as president and CEO in late 2021. In fact, I met you at a CEONet conference and you disclosed that you were like brand spanking new. I remember that. That was in Denver,
right.
I think. Yeah, you're relatively new. But you have 15 years of philanthropy and community development leadership experience working across private, nonprofit, and government sectors. You have led efforts to maximize community impact through philanthropy planning and collaboration. Before joining LCF, which is kind of funny, that's kind of what we go by as well, Alec served as the vice president of community development and corporate philanthropy for First National Bank of, is it Omaha or First National Bank?
Of Omaha.
Of Omaha, okay. And was president of FNBO Community Development Corporation, where you established and led the organization's modern philanthropy and community investment division. You hold a master in public administration from the University of Nebraska at Omaha and a bachelor of science degree in psychology and criminal justice from Peru State College. What did you want to do with psychology and criminal justice?
I wanted to focus on addiction and addiction counseling is what I specialized in. When I was in high school, I was a police cadet. So Friday nights, I would, you know, a couple times a month, I'd don my police cadet uniform and I'd get to go on these ride alongs. I had to earn it. You know, we had to go through all this training and development and these tests. And I'd go on these ride alongs on the third shift in Topeka, Kansas, and saw some pretty wild stuff. So anyway, at one point I thought I wanted to do that. I think I got my fix just by riding along and seeing the stuff. So then I decided, well, there's another way to help people. So I pursued the psychology. I don't know if there's a reason why I connected with addiction. Probably. I wonder if it's because of what I saw. Also some stuff in my family, as is the case with many families, but then never ended up doing with anything with that. Went and got a master's degree and wanted to find another way to serve communities.
See, now you threw me with that answer. I thought you were going to say, I watched a lot of detective shows. I wanted to be, you know, like CSI or something like that. And you didn't. And I'm kind of shocked. So,
well, that too, you know?
Yeah, cool. So let's see. We're going to give you the gratuitous question. What are you listening to? Music, podcasts, any favorite songs right now or anything you're watching, reading? Doesn't have to be the most erudite thing in the world. It could be a guilty pleasure on TV or whatever. What are you enjoying?
Well, concert season has just been announced, right? And so a lot of bands are announcing about their tours. And we've got a great little venue here in Lincoln called Pinewood Bowl. A lot of people compare it to Red Rocks, except it's outdoor, except without the cliffs on either side. You're framed by this thick row of pine trees. So it's a really cool venue to be in. And they've got two shows coming up that I'm excited for. And as is the case, whenever I'm about to go to a show, I just like binge listen to the artist. And so Cake is touring, if you remember.
Oh,
Cake.
Yeah.
And so we're going to see them in May. And then just yesterday, I bought tickets to go see with my wife and some friends, Vampire Weekend. Band. And so anyway, I've been obsessively listening to Cake and Vampire Weekend.
Wow, that's cool. Yeah. Anything you're reading or enjoying on the tube?
I don't get to read much, but I just got back from a vacation and was able to get about halfway through a book by Stephen Ambrose. He writes a lot of history books, mm-hmm. And this one's called Nothing Like It in the World, I think. It's about the Transcontinental Railroad. And holy cow, I didn't really fully appreciate all that took: government, capitalism, leadership, risk, a lot of bad stuff too. Also, having lived in Nebraska, I have a newfound appreciation for Omaha and its role in the Transcontinental Railroad. I spent, 15 years in Omaha. Love that community as much as I do Lincoln, and just didn't really fully appreciate the role that Omaha played in building the Transcontinental Railroad.
I didn't know that at all. I had no idea, no clue.
Much more than you were looking for there.
So, are you a native Nebraskan?
I was born in Lincoln, where I am currently the president of the Community Foundation, but I moved away from here when I was a young kid. We moved to Kansas. That's where I went to middle school and high school. Never thought I'd come back to Lincoln. My parents weren't even here. And, you know, they were back in Kansas. I made my way back up to Nebraska to go to college and graduate school in Omaha. Spent this great career in community development and philanthropy and investing, and was ready for something new, and had done some things with the Lincoln Community Foundation and my predecessor here. And as she retired, I thought to myself, huh, maybe that's something I could try back in a place that I originally called home. And so that's how I literally had this full circle journey, or closed this full circle journey, right back here to Lincoln.
Well, that's excellent. So you have a lot.
But I am a Husker through and through, football, basketball, you name it.
Gosh, you know, back in the day, that would have been fighting words, you know, see you grad and all. But anyway.
Oh, yeah.
So I neglected to ask you if you have a secret skill. I remember our conversation at Wichita, and we talked, you know, I talked a little bit about your family and, you know, and your role at the Community Foundation. And I don't remember seeing like a secret passion or hearing about a secret passion or secret skill.
Oh, man. Secret skill. I don't even know if I have any apparent skills, you know? I don't know.
I think you're affable. I think that's a great skill. You're a likable person. You're likable.
Oh, so, yeah. Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I do love people. And you know what? That's the secret skill. I feel like I am friends with everyone I've ever met. And you know, I could have met you once. Eric, I probably described you as a friend to someone, and you and I have only met a couple times now. But I have this ability to be friends, and honestly have good, genuine relationships with everyone I meet. So I'll call that a secret skill.
I think it is a good secret skill, especially, you know, I think it's a really something to be proud of. So that's really cool. So let's pivot to your community. So tell us about what's going on in your community. Describe Lincoln for people who don't know it. Cause I think the first thing that people think about when they think of Nebraska is probably Nebraska football. And maybe Warren Buffett. Warren Buffett. So anyway, yeah, go ahead.
I thought you were going to say cornfields.
No, you know, I think that again, you know what I have to say, whenever I hear from other people and they always say, oh, Nebraska and Kansas, it's flat and there's just corn. And I'm like, you know what? Just go there. You know, don't you know, it actually raises the hackles in me a little bit. So I have to say, yeah.
Same. I love Nebraska. I love the rural communities. I love the urban communities. I've lived in rural communities. I've lived in urban communities in Nebraska. I love Nebraska through and through. Like, granted, much of the state physically is rural, and corn and beef, by the way, which probably feeds, you know, and pork, which probably feeds a lot of the country. But Omaha and Lincoln are the urban centers, and they're have many of the qualities and attributes of many urban communities throughout our country. Lincoln, in particular, is the capital of Nebraska. It is also the home of our land grant institution, which also happened at the same time as the Transcontinental Railroad was built. And so to that end, it's a university town, and it's a government town. So our capital, it is the capital, but it's also got a bunch of great enterprising individuals who have started really great businesses here 100 years ago and even 1 to 5 years ago. And so we've got a lot of great enterprising individuals. So it doesn't really kind of fit into any one form. It isn't a traditional government town. It isn't a traditional university town. We have a little bit of everything. We've got about 300,000 individuals here. I couldn't tell you the square mileage of our community or anything like that. We're median income, probably just around $92,000 a year is median income, just to give you a flavor of our earnings in this community. Probably not too far off from anyone else. Poverty around 12%. So it's at or about what many other urban Midwestern communities of a similar size would probably be. So it's a great place, though. We really enjoy, there's tons to do from a family standpoint. We've got young kids. So, you know, always something to do, always somewhere to be, something to put a smile on our face. A lot of great nightlife. You know, we were just talking about the concerts and stuff. So there's really something for everyone here. We really enjoy it.
So, you know, I'm going to go down a rabbit hole a little bit, but is Nebraska the only major university in the state of Nebraska? Kind of like with Wyoming, they only have one major university.
We have three D1 schools. University of Nebraska, Lincoln, which is the Huskers, go Big Red. Next year's our year. We say that every year. This year's our year, man. We keep living in the 90s.
Yeah, exactly. You do.
But we also affiliated with the University of Nebraska Lincoln, or loosely affiliated, or whatever the term is University of Nebraska Omaha, which is a D1 school, more known for hockey. And then of course Creighton University.
Oh yeah, that's right.
Creighton, who is currently sitting at 12th in the NCAA basketball standings. There's a thing here though. I am considered, which is a bad word here, I'm considered a Jaysker, where it's where you are a fan of both the Creighton Blue Jays and the Nebraska Huskers. It's often believed that you're one or the other. And if you live in Omaha and you own a sweater vest, chances are you're going to be a Blue Jay fan. Or if you live in Lincoln, and it's not necessarily unique to those geographies, but it's either or. And I am proudly a Jaysker. Now, when the two play each other, I'll cheer for the Huskers. But I just think that when any of our teams are doing well, like we're both doing well this year in basketball, it's good for the whole state. So I cheer them both on. I also cheer on the D2 school and the community college and whoever in our state is competing. I'm here for it.
You are a true fan. So good job. That's there. Right. Yeah. I'm a very community oriented. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. All right. So everything is rosy and wonderful in Nebraska. We know, but what are the challenges? What do you see as the challenges in Nebraska and specifically in your community?
Well, the things I'm going to say are probably things that you hear from a number of your guests and things that you're experiencing there, but it's affordable housing. It's early childhood education. It's workforce development. And affordable housing and early childhood education as a contributor probably to our workforce development challenges. Now, while that's not new, the Community Foundation has been talking about and elevating these as issues for years now, you know, probably 8 years now. We have, we lead, something called Prosper Lincoln, which is really our community agenda. We take this collective impact mindset and approach. It's not purely collective impact, so don't go comparing what we do to what Stanford Social Innovation Review says we should do. But we're on the same page is what is important here, and we have these mutually reinforceable activities. But 8 years ago, under our Prosper Lincoln community agenda, we first elevated workforce development and early childhood education. And then a couple of years later, added affordable housing as something that was of significant pressing concern inhibiting socioeconomic prosperity for Lincolnites. And so we've done some work in each of those areas, and we can go down those rabbit holes if you like. But the work that we've done has established the infrastructure that we now have in place responding to this thing that the rest of our community is starting to say, hey, we've got a big problem here. It's inhibiting our ability to grow. It's inhibiting our ability to recruit businesses, to recruit talent, whatever the case may be. So in fact, we had a close partnership with our Chamber of Commerce here, and they just went through strategic planning about a year and a half ago. And through their strategic plan, they identified housing and early childhood education. Our Chamber of Commerce did. Same with our state chamber. But anyway, the consultants they had for the chamber said, or for the plan said, you know what we would recommend in any other community is that you build this type of partnership and a public-private partnership, an organization to kind of tackle early childhood education head on. But they said, we don't need to recommend that here because the Lincoln Community Foundation already started something. And what you need to do is put your weight behind it. So we feel like we're a couple of steps ahead of hopefully of some of the other communities. But now these are really common topics that everyone's talking about.
No, you've hit on the big three that I like to call them that everybody really talks about in every community. It's pretty rare that somebody doesn't mention that at all.
Yeah.
So can you describe the work that was done to get you to this point, to kind of do that study work, to do that background work, to do that, all of that work?
Yeah. And I want to give credit to It, no individual owns credit for any of this, but to a large part and playing a big role was my predecessor, a woman named Barbara Bartle, who was in this role at the Community Foundation for about 12 years, really turned it around. And in addition to turning it around, she was she kind of took over at the time in which the community foundations across the country were kind of understanding and leaning into this community leadership role. And the Lincoln Community Foundation, under her leadership, was really kind of on the leading edge of that. And it started, to answer your question, with the data project, to kind of understand the socioeconomic status of our community and get a report card on the socioeconomic realities of our community. We called that Lincoln Vital Signs. And from that, pulling together different collaborators and institutions, be it the city or the university or the chamber or whomever, you know, kind of putting them in the room and diving into that information and forming some conclusions about it and identifying like, well, now we know this, what are we going to do about it? And that's how early on workforce development and early childhood education were identified about in 2015 as we need to spend some time and energy on this. One of the first, and no one in this community was really talking about workforce development that much back then. One of the first things that they did in each of those areas is they hired individuals they called drivers. Those were individuals who, you know, simply put, were hired to wake up every day and understand and develop solutions and partnerships to address those areas. And there's a gentleman that was hired to be the workforce development driver. And he was first an employee of the Community Foundation. And eventually we wanted to embed these individuals within other organizations to help those other organizations lead in those areas. And so this gentleman eventually became, and through some funding that we provided, an employee of the Chamber of Commerce, who now has an entire department dedicated to workforce development. Now, I'm not saying that, yes, we started that and that's how it happened. They may have eventually added a workforce development person and a workforce development division on their own. But we did have a hand in kind of creating that early on. And there's a similar story in each of our other areas of kind of leading the understanding and the nuanced, what it takes is a nuanced understanding of these really complex community challenges so that you can be the one that folks turn to try to understand why we're experiencing challenges, where the barriers are, where the inhibitors are, where the opportunities for change and evolution are, and then develop partnerships to kind of go about making those improvements. And I would say that while we're still experiencing significant here and everywhere else workforce housing, early childhood education challenges, we have realized significant successes over the past few years, either organizational and institutional successes, putting the systems pieces in place to address those challenges, and also some real human impacts, which is, of course, the most important thing that we want to realize when we talk about socioeconomic prosperity. Yet we're still facing these insurmountable challenges, and the challenges are because they're macroeconomic in nature. And what we're trying to do is manipulate things on a smaller scale in order to have some success and have some progress given those macroeconomic constraints.
So describe a success then. Like what are some of those things? I mean, you talked about like you're making movements, you're making progress. So describe a couple of success stories.
Yeah, let me talk about early childhood education for a minute. And we, a few years ago, established I assume a lot of the listeners here are other community foundation nerds like us. And we created a fiscally sponsored organization. It didn't come to us. We created it. It's called Lincoln Littles. We eventually might move it into a supporting org type thing. Again, just for the nerd language here. And Lincoln Littles is a fiscally sponsored organization of the Community Foundation with a group of people who wake up every day thinking about early childhood education. I kind of liken them to the Chamber of Childcare, really. They have a network of early childhood education providers that they work with. They're not members, but they're working with them to understand and address their challenges and taking advantage of opportunities at a scale that would impact all of them. They're working with individual families to provide direct tuition assistance to these providers. So there's a financial element that we're granting, providing direct cash assistance to families, which is also kind of coming online. You're seeing a lot lately.
Nice.
Some of the foundations. That's not a systemic thing, but that is something that's an important part of our strategy. That's not a systems thing. Workforce development is a big challenge within these providers. You're talking about folks who are making $13 an hour, $14 an hour. They could just as easily go somewhere else to a fast food type of a place in order to make that wage. And so they're developing some workforce development strategies to help that system out a little bit. One of those workforce development strategies is they're offering a class. And it is a means by which they can recruit people who are interested in the field, as well as provide training and development for people who are just new to the field, something that it isn't currently provided. And while they're in the class, they're giving them a stipend, and they're also providing them with some type of cash assistance so they themselves can afford childcare. And so they go through the program, they graduate, they get placed with a provider, and now they're working. They're adding capacity to the field. And for the next year, they have this financial resources to pay for childcare for their own kids. Fast forward a little bit, down the line, and one of our state senators has introduced a bill to do just that, to change the subsidy, the state subsidy requirements or allowances to include employees of early childhood education providers. And so you can kind of just see how we're trying to lead by example here. We're doing something that is at a scale that is meaningful for our local network of providers. And then that example then gets converted into a public policy, which is debated through committee and is getting debated on the floor right now. And there's actually three or four examples of something that Lincoln Littles, our early childhood fiscally sponsored organization we created, that they have either sparked or are doing or have suggested that have been converted into by others, have been converted into bills that have been introduced into our legislature. So that's how we're trying to see that success that we know will eventually have an impact beyond what that organization is able to do independently.
I love that. So a couple of follow-up questions. So direct tuition assistance, what is that? How much does that look like? What does it look like? Can you describe that just a little bit more fully?
Yep, I sure can. So the tuition assistance is funded by, we actually just wrapped up our annual campaign yesterday, a really successful campaign, but it's funded by a mix of the Lincoln Community Foundation, by some other peer foundations, and a lot of individual donors. We've, of course, like many community foundations, have donor advised funds. And there are circumstances in which we'll go to our donor advised funds and say, hey, this is a big deal. This is important. It's inhibiting our socioeconomic prosperity as a community. We invite you to be a part of it with us. And so that's how the tuition assistance is funded. It amounts to, on average, about, I think, $2,500 per kid.
That's awesome. Yeah.
That and it's geared towards families who are in the gap. They make too much money to be eligible for state subsidy, but they don't make enough money to, quite frankly, afford care that they need in order to work, in order to they themselves be economically successful, and also that our community needs folks to work. And so it's a big inhibitor to our workforce challenges. So we're just straight up trying to bring that cost of care down to a level that is more affordable. But just to translate that into a public policy dynamic or thing, is that we're doing something meaningful, and we're helping out a few hundred kids a year, and that's important. And our donors are helping us do that, and that's important, and it feels good, and it makes a difference. The problem is well beyond what we can raise and what we could administer. Lincoln has about 10,000 kids under the age of 5. We know that 75% of kids in our community have all parents in the workforce, meaning that they require care in order to allow those parents to work. So we're talking 7,500 kids need care. If you look at care, should only cost about 7% of your income. Mm-hmm. So if you look at the incomes of those 7,500 kids and our distribution of income in our community, it would cost us about $17 million a year as a community just to not fully fund access to early childhood education, but just bring it down to an affordable rate for those 7,500 kids.
So it'd be the 7% of income that was spent on it, basically, is what you're saying. Yeah.
And so it would be, so at so that's the scale of the problem, $17 million a year. And we're hitting it at maybe somewhere between $750,000 and $1 million a year, which is great. It's meaningful. But that's why we started to think more strategically about the role public policy can play in this, because we're talking about macroeconomic factors that are really kind of immovable, at least as far as our influence goes. And so if we can invite our public policy, our friends in public policy to be a part of the solution, and that's also what happened last year. A state senator introduced a bill, and we were part of the advocacy effort there, that effectively is a child care tax credit, which was an amount just about equal to the very amount of money that we're putting back to the hands of families. So with a swipe of a pen, we're able to unlock so much more financial resources back to these families. And I think that as a community foundation, that's exactly what we're supposed to be doing. As Lincoln's community foundation, we're trying to solve Lincoln's problems. And it isn't just about philanthropy. Yes, philanthropy is a primary means by which we're doing it, but we need to think about every tool at our disposal. And so we think the state government this year, we're going to start to explore some partnerships with the city to continue to be a part of that solution. And so that's where we're trying to spend a good amount of time.
I was going to ask you, do you have a lobbyist that helps you with that? Or was that literally bills introduced and you said, oh my gosh, this is advantageous to the goals of the Lincoln Littles, and so let's move along with that? Or was there some sort of coordinated lobbying effort too?
There was a lot of intention behind it. It was neither of those things. It wasn't completely catching us off guard. We officially don't have a lobbyist. Actually, I'm a registered lobbyist just because we don't want to get in any trouble. But I'm not a lobbyist with skill and professionalism like people who spend their entire careers doing it. I'm just doing it so we don't get in trouble. We do have relationships with other institutions who have similar goals as ours, and they too recognize the role that government can play in helping address these solutions. They themselves have lobbyists. So it's collectively we're working on these solutions together. The early childhood education example, there's a great public policy advocacy firm here in town just focused on early childhood education. And so we're feeding them the things that we're doing, and we're inviting them to our table so they can see by example, so they can see the work that we're doing. And then they're the ones who have the experienced relationships to kind of take that to elected officials and get those things introduced.
Oh, that's
same could
awesome.
Same can be said for affordable housing. We're working with our partners at the city or the Chamber of Commerce who share affordable housing goals. They know more about how a bill becomes a law. I only know about it from the Schoolhouse Rock Live. So, and so we can, you know, we can talk about what we know and what we believe to be true and important. And then they're the ones that kind of help make it happen. And we play a role in it. You know, we're doing some advocacy and some education on our own, but we're working with others to get things introduced to answer your question.
Yeah. So what, along with early childhood care and such, what you mentioned kind of working with the city and working with other institutions, chamber and such, about affordable housing and other things. Anything else you want to like kind of talk about in that space that you're working on specifically?
Well, affordable housing is a similar story to early childhood education. You know, it's the macroeconomic factors are making housing affordable for many Lincolnites and many folks throughout our country and many of the communities that folks are in. And it's we have this massive affordability gap. And, you know, philanthropy is going to can play a role, but not God, it's a drop in the bucket, you know, to close the affordability gap, to actually invest in a developer who then can offer housing at a rate that is affordable for lower moderate income families. That's a significant investment needed, and you definitely need government to play a role there. And so just kind of taking a similar tact and similar approach, what we're seeing though, and this is alarming, is that, you know, this gap isn't new. It's always existed, this affordability gap in housing, just like early childhood education. It's not new. I mean, the federal low income housing tax credit program dates back to the 80s. We were doing housing programs under, you know, FDR. I mean, that's not new. And investing in access to housing for low and moderate income families, I came from banking. Those are terms that we would use. So maybe they're not totally universal, but, you know, generally speaking, low income families. That's not new. But what is new and is alarming is that we're now seeing investments in housing for middle income families. We hear and a term that a lot of folks are using, and I've heard it more so over the past 5 years, is this workforce housing, which the term kind of irritates me because it assumes that if low income folks aren't working, they are working.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of an unfair characterization, but it's the term that's being used. But traditionally, workforce housing is supporting families who are 90, 100, 120% of median family income. Now, it's not directly subsidizing those families. They can afford a $300,000 home. It's just that no $300,000 homes are being built. So we have to invest in developers to de-risk their ability, to de-risk them rather, so that they can build some of these homes that are affordable then for a middle income family. So that's how big this problem has gotten. So similar story, working with the chamber and the city and to with the legislature to have some advances there as well. So there's another thing we're working on. You know, our Chamber of Commerce has just been a fantastic collaborating partner on all of these things. In both of these cases, they're deferring to us. And some other things that we defer to them. One thing that we're working on together is, you know, their strategic plan. If you think beyond what we're talking about now, totally different kind of chapter and verse, is, you know, a community, a vibrant community for visitors and residents alike, requires some great civic assets, be it ballparks or music district,
concert venue or whatever. Yeah.
All of those things. And our history as a community to create those things has required this public-private partnership between business, philanthropy, government, all of which are showing up, leveraging their capitals, their social, political, and financial capital to make those things happen. And we saw a lot of great progress and growth and development in our community through partnerships like that. We're trying to re-spark some partnerships and re-ideate around what's next. What are we? How can business, philanthropy, and the city work together to build more, you know, kind of big transformational community assets? So we're working on that. We're pretty early in that, so not too much else to share right now. But that's something I'm really excited about, and again, a role I think a community foundation should play. We are. I use this phrase a lot, and it's a little on the nose, I suppose, but we are the community's foundation. Mm-hmm. So as the community's foundation, we have a huge diverse set of purposes and responsibilities to just for the betterment of the community through the power of leadership and philanthropy. And that can it evolves and it changes over time. It also we have a ton of flexibility to do what we need to do what's right for our constituents. I'm sure you've heard it and said it. Once you've seen one community foundation, you've seen one community foundation. So we're just trying to fulfill what people in our community expect and need from us.
Yeah, I think the leadership thing is that people just absolutely appreciate that and the partnerships and collaboration. And, you know, it certainly is inspiring to hear you talk about your great relationship with the chamber and other things. That's awesome because a lot of people don't enjoy that same partnership, if you will. I was going to ask you one more follow-up regarding the housing is that, you know, I think a lot of people would be surprised that housing is an issue in Lincoln because I just think of you as like, oh, you have expansive land probably and development and you can add more supply to that. And so that will lower prices. And I just feel like, you know, again, you're not hemmed in by any, you know, giant mountains like some of our mountain communities are in Colorado and other places. And so, you know, demystify that myth that I have, obviously.
Well, you know, of course, there's a lot of land, but that land is serving, you know, the land outside of Lincoln anyway, is serving productive agricultural purposes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so we want to be really careful about that. But of course, there's also, you know, the cities continue to grow, you know, slowly over time. That's a reality. That takes infrastructure and, you know, all kinds of other really massive investment over time. We do have a land challenge. If you ask any affordable housing developer around here, what one of the main inhibitors to their ability to develop, they'll say dirt, access to land.
Yeah, yeah.
We don't have, you know, you look at some other communities and they've got even up the street in Omaha and they have a problem, which is also an opportunity, of a lot of vacant and abandoned properties. And so they have developed tools then to leverage those vacant and abandoned properties to convert them to public, or excuse me, productive community development and more commonly affordable housing purposes. We don't have a lot of, in the core, we don't have a lot of vacant and abandoned land. There's certainly some housing opportunities, but it's just so, or some, you know, parcel opportunities, but it's just so limited that it's a competition to get the property, driving up the price. And in some cases, I can't tell either organization this because they said this in confidence, and I won't say their names here, but there's two nonprofit organizations bidding for the same piece of land and just driving up the price on one another. And so, no, there's, you know, we have abundance in a great number of things, and we do have an abundance of land, but it's just not readily available for, particularly on the outskirts of the city, it's just not readily available for housing development at this moment.
And it doesn't mean it's dirt cheap either. So
no, definitely doesn't mean it's dirt cheap. Yeah, it's a commodity.
Absolutely. So one final topic I want to just ask you about. You just had this donor advised fund challenge that we were talking about before we got on the air. Can you describe to that? And the one fascinating thing is you don't charge a fee for your donor advised funds.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I mean, the Lincoln Community Foundation is the first community foundation I've worked for. So I just thought that was normal. Certainly I volunteered with the Omaha Community Foundation when I lived in Omaha, and they're fantastic in a number of respects. But the Lincoln Community Foundation, I come here and I learn, okay, our business model is, you know, we've got endowed funds. We're also very fortunate that gives us the ability to do that. We have endowed funds. We generate a fee on those endowed funds that supports our operating budget. We also have a operating endowment itself, which generates a grant that supports our operating budget. And that's where we get most of our earned revenue to support our operations. We believe, as Frederick Goff believed, that a community foundation is a place where anyone could be should be a philanthropist or can be a philanthropist. And so we don't want to be inaccessible or unattainable. And so we want to be accessible. We want to be a place where anybody can be a philanthropist. So we have free donor advised funds. If the donor advised fund is held in cash, if it's an invested donor advised fund, of course, we have expenses then that are affiliated with that. And so we do charge a probably comparable fee to what anybody else here does. But we have quite a few donor advised funds that are held in cash. And there's no minimum balance on those either. We just want to encourage the act of philanthropy and allow anybody to do it. The trade-off, though, is that we get to use the cash to generate revenue for our operations as an organization. And for many years, that's generated a modest amount of revenue. It's been fine. Of course, over the past couple of years, we've seen interest rates really jump up. And so we've been able to generate a good amount of revenue on our cash and end this past year with a pretty nice surplus. Well, that's the community surplus. And so we were really thoughtful on how we're going to reinvest that money back into our organization and back into our community. And there's a couple of ways in which we're reinvesting into the organization, which is meaningful for our infrastructure and our operations and our people. But as far as the community goes, we took some of the resources and we're investing it back into affordable housing and early childhood education, which is, we think, our responsibility. But we also want to acknowledge that it is the donor advised fund holders that hold those funds in cash that gave us the ability to generate that revenue. And they themselves are reinvesting back in the community. So we wanted to develop an opportunity for them to reinvest some of this money back into the community in partnership with us. So just starting today, actually, March 1st, donor advised fund match campaign. If you have an existing donor advised fund held in cash, we will match dollar for dollar up to $1,000 into your donor advised fund. So we're not trying to generate new donor advised funds with this. We're just trying to reinvest in our community through the people who have been partnering with us for their philanthropy for years now. And already today, the phone has been ringing off the hook. People have been walking in the door really just appreciative of allowing them to help us reinvest in our community together. Couple people have also commented, like, this is why we partner with a community foundation and not someone else that could do this. So It's just been day one. We limited the amount of money that we have available for this. It's a good amount of money, but it's capped. We're afraid it's going to run out pretty quick.
Yeah. Well, and so I want to clarify one of the things that you're saying is like you make money on the cash, which is obviously you have an interest bearing account or you have an interest bearing sort of portfolio strategy for that cash. Is that correct? So I just want to be clear on that with the listeners. So yeah,
yep, that's correct. We use the cash. We put it in very secure instruments. We do have some short term bonds as well. Mm-hmm. But you know,
Everybody don't come at Alec because he's like doing this offshore weird money laundering thing and bringing it back from somewhere else. So yeah.
No, you're thanks for clarifying that. Yeah.
All right. Anything I haven't asked you that you'd love to kind of entertain before I let you go and get back with your day and obviously helping people kind of add to their donor advice with this amazing match.
Yeah. You know, I think we've covered a wide range of things. I appreciate what you're doing. I think community foundations are really important instruments in the well-being of our communities. Helping is the only place for folks can come together and solve common problems together. And so I just appreciate your bringing awareness and advocacy to the field.
No, I appreciate the sentiment very much. And I also appreciate you being here today, Alec, and joining me on the show. And I want to thank everybody for listening. As always, thanks to Andy Epler and David Cutter for our music, too, as well. If you have any questions, reach out at emergencyf@gmail.com. Thank you so much and have a great week.